Joel, super excited to chat with you. We go way back, so having the opportunity to interview you today is an honor, a thrill, and I'm excited to get your story out there, to get the listeners to get a glimpse into your wonderful mind and how you think about content, copy, AI, case studies, branding, B2B, all of this stuff. There's so many things that I'm excited to jump into today. So before we jump into it, I'm going to start from the early stages. So, talk me through your career path, your transition over the last few years, and what got you to where you are today. Like, take me back, first experience digital technology all the way through to today.
So I left university knowing more about the kind of people I wanted to be around than what I wanted to do. I did an entrepreneurship degree because I liked being around people that were kind of starting things and building things. I knew that I loved to write, never saw a career path in it at all, just wrote that off completely. So my story kind of started where I left university not knowing where I'd be. I got a job in digital doing SEO, which was a job I'd never heard of at the time. I kind of fell backwards into it. I have a friend, John Lee, at an agency, and he's like, "Hey, you should come check this out. It's small, it's fun, it's a good environment." So I, my only question was, "Do I have to cold call?" And he's like, "No." So, started out doing SEO there, and it was through that experience that I got my first real like agency experience in terms of like pitching to clients and structuring campaigns and working on deliverables. But it's also where my eyes kind of opened to the value and importance of content all over again, and where I realized like, hey, there actually is a market for what I love to do. I don't have to be a journalist. I don't have to write fiction novels. I can do this content thing. So I started to get a few little projects through the agency, doing some blog posts, some web copy, and that eventually culminated in 2013. I was so excited about that opportunity and where I saw the industry going that I left the agency world, went out on my own in freelancing. So originally doing content, then encountered the work of Joanna Wiebe, realized, I've been kind of familiarized with direct response, but my posture towards that at times like, oh, I want nothing to do with that. Because my exposure to it was all like the scummy side of it, the like miracle cures and like sketchy financial. But when I saw Joanna's work and when I kind of encountered her, that's the first time I said, hey, there's like a super legitimate, like I can help people make the right decision. I can help position companies. That's really cool. So within 2 years of being out on my own, had transitioned into the conversion side of things. And then from there, was doing that, just wrapped up a project for WP Engine. Someone who sat on their board said, hey, that went really well. Do you do case studies? I have a little company I advise. They need one. And it was kind of one of those people who are like, yeah, for you, anything, of course. Like, yeah, I'll figure it out. So it wasn't doing that project that my eyes opened to the opportunity of customer stories and the potential for that. So off the side of my desk, kind of launched Case Study Buddy and brought in a partner. And then eventually that grew under its own steam to the point where just before the pandemic hit, the decision was made, hey, we should go all in on this and see how far we can take it and where this goes. So kind of put the conversion side of things, I keep saying on pause. I don't know if it becomes unpaused or just manifests in some other way in the future. But that's been my focus the past few years now is Case Study Buddy, customer stories, and the various iterations of that from written to video to social and everything beyond. So that is kind of a start to finish trajectory of like how I got into digital and how it all built up to now.
I love it. I appreciate that. And then along the way, building a family and doing all kinds of cool stuff like that. So I appreciate the rundown. I want to jump into the case study side because you're prolific. You're one of the most well-known and sought after like B2B people as it relates to this topic of case studies. And you've worked with, created, planned, strategized a ton of them. When it comes to B2B, a lot of organizations struggle with creating a case study engine in-house. When it comes to outsourcing it and getting support with a partner, what do you see as like the benefits of that and why they should be more comfortable with not trying to grind their wheels and grind their gears internally and why they should probably look for outside help?
Yeah, I think number one, like recognizing that bringing in a partner doesn't mean giving up the relationship or putting distance between you and the client. I think that's a huge fear for companies is we should be the ones conducting these interviews. And if someone else is putting these together, well, we're missing that opportunity to talk to the client and learn and grow. And that's absolutely not the case. If we're doing our jobs right, we're actually creating more opportunities for dialogue. We're providing more insight. We're doing this one piece of that customer marketing more efficiently and with more strategy than maybe you have time or attention to warrant. And then coming back to you, not only with collateral and assets that you can go and use, but also insights that now you can build a program on, you can deepen a program on. I think so many companies struggle with this because it's a team sport without a captain. In a lot of organizations, I mean, customer marketing is starting to really pick up. We're seeing more people being appointed to roles in customer marketing and advocacy. But even for multi-billion dollar brands, there's not a lot of ownership. There's not a lot of process. We ask every client that comes in the door, do you have an SOP for this stuff? Do you have processes for this stuff? And almost universally, the answer is no, or what we have isn't good. It's not up to date. It's not shared. It's not distributed. So to bring in a partner gives you the ability to focus on the pieces of the relationship that really matter, the other high pressure initiatives that, that you have, and allows us to come in and kind of not take that away from you, but accelerate it, walk you through it, build it with you, shed light to how to get there faster. And then when it comes to the actual production, do that in a way that honors your time, honors the client, and more importantly, is strategic, because we have the time and focus and experience to be strategic versus just tell any old story.
I love it. I'm going to take you back into time. 2016, it's a long time ago. You created a piece where you talked about how jargon isn't always a bad thing. And I loved this piece way back then. And it's still something that I see people say all the time. Like, I go to events, I listen to podcasts, and people are saying, like, we need to stop using jargon. Jargon is trash. We shouldn't use it. But you said, I love jargon, and you should use it if you want to make more money. Tell me a little bit more about why you have that belief. And if you've changed your belief over the years, that's okay too. But I'd love to know, like, the premise of that idea.
Yeah, I mean, jargon is the lexicon and code of your clients. It's how they communicate internally. And so, yes, I mean, meaningless jargon, jargon for the sake of jargon, your own personal jargon, none of that is valuable. But if you're trying to sell into an audience, let's take cybersecurity, for example. If you want to win business from cybersecurity companies, if, let's say you're creating content or whatever, if you can't come in and speak the language, if you don't know the acronyms, if you don't know the stack and the language, if you don't talk like they do, they recognize you as an outsider from a mile away and their confidence erodes. I think there's a massive difference between jargon that's essentially just like flowery language and trying to sound self-important, and what I alluded to earlier, which is the lexicon and code of your clients. It's how they identify. I mean, ask an engineer about their jargon and they hold it close and dear. It's almost like gatekeeping to an extent. It's like, hey, if you know the code, you can get in the door. If you don't know the code, you're not, you're not one of us. So I haven't changed my mind on that. In fact, I think I've only entrenched that thought further, because when we go to tell stories, even to people in the same industry, but in different roles, if I'm selling to a CTO, my language, my jargon's going to be different than if I'm selling to a CMO or a CEO, as will my focus. So I still very much hold that belief. I still think jargon is a wonderful thing when you wield it properly.
So you're coming in from the outside. There's a bunch of jargon thrown in the industry. Let's say you're talking to QA engineers or something technical. And how do you get the jargon out of those people? Are you interviewing them? Are you reading forums? Like, how do you typically approach it?
I think number one, you want to look at what already exists, right? And there's an abundance of content and conversations out there. You just have to know where to look. So for example, we love digging into successful sales conversations. What is it that the salesperson is keying into? Where are they mirroring jargon? Where are they already winning? We love to look at, you know, well-crafted winning positioning and winning landing pages. What kinds of messaging are there? What kind of acronyms are used there? Cool. We do want to, where we can, you know, when I was working heavily on the conversion side of things, we do want to eavesdrop on communities and on social, and look at, again, when they talk as peers, go listen to podcasts. If there's people in that space talking to each other, go listen to a podcast. What's the language like there? Get that transcript, pop it into script, go through, take a highlighter, highlight all the jargon, right? Yep. Like what is naturally coming up? These are things that now with the emergence of AI, you can do rapidly too, right? Yeah. You can take some of these recordings or videos or things from the industry, put it all together,
right?
And get a bit of a roadmap for, okay, if I'm communicating in this space, like how do they talk to each other in a natural setting? So whether that's sales calls, podcasts, videos, communities, get your feet wet first. And then I think it's about validating, right? Then start having some conversations yourself, because practice is the best teacher when it comes to using these things. You don't want to be that person who's like, hello, fellow kids, like trying to use this slang of, you know, Gen Z, like you know, we're all like 1,000 years late on things like no cap.
So, right.
You want to see like what's current too and how it lands when you're using it. But I think that's a good entry point, a good starting point is some of those third
parties. I love it. I want to go a little deeper on the sales conversations and make it very tactical for folks. So you want to use sales calls. What does that mean? Are you showing up on the sales calls? Are you just reaching out to the sales team, asking them what the combos are saying? Are you listening? What are you doing? How does that work?
I mean, the ideal is when they're already deploying a tool like Fathom or Gong, or, you know, they've got these recordings available. I think the best modern sales teams are using their sawdust. They're using these recordings, these byproducts of sales calls already to improve. In the absence of those things, absolutely, you want to shadow. So if you can just be a fly on the wall, if you can, again, get them to record those conversations. Cool.
And then when you have those recordings, what are you doing with those assets? Like, what are you doing with it once you have those recordings?
So once you've got those, I mean, you want to listen. I don't want to understate the importance of actually listening to the calls, not just reading the transcripts, at least in the beginning, because you want to hear the cadence, the flow. Once you have a sense for that, at that point, it depends on the tool, the stack, but typically you're transcribing it, you're exporting it, and then you're looking for themes. Again, you're getting that highlighter out and you're looking for what is said, what is the response to what is said. And then for me, you're validating that. So you're not doing this in a vacuum, like, hey, sales, just give me your recordings, I'll be fine.
Right.
You want to take what you learn and then come back to sales and say, these are things I'm observing. These are things that I'm noticing. Do you notice the same things? Am I on the right track here? And I'll ask pointed questions of sales too. Like, how do you know? I'm hearing you combat this objection in this way. Where did you learn that? Why do you think that's so effective? What did you try before that was less effective? Because we forget to do that too. We look at the present, look backwards, because the most successful people have evolved and iterated. This is not their first swing.
Right.
They can tell you where the landmines are. So really, it's listening, transcribing, then validating observations with sales. And then from there, again, now you have some baseline, some confidence to create and test.
Nice.
Put it together.
Very cool. So with all of that insight, like, talk me through the way that your team would absorb this research, dive into it, and then figure out the structure and story that would show up in like a powerful customer story case study.
Yeah, I think so. There's a difference between how I would do it on my own when I was doing conversion, because then I have the luxury of time and I can take a lot of that. For my team, we have to do that in a really truncated way. So again, for our team, it's about getting as much as we can in as succinct a window as we can, be that transcripts, live demos, watch, observe, absorb. And then from there, again, we're trying to capture this kind of in a internal sort of company customer brief. So taking notes, centralizing this so the team has a sense, an idea of what is said, what is the language. Almost, you know, something that I think we're working on, we could do better at. I think part of it's been the quest for the right tool, but building almost an internal wiki.
Oh, interesting.
An internal client wiki where it's like, this is the offering. This is what makes it valuable. This is the language that people use. These are some resources so that if one of our team, you know, it's the terrible enough, but if they get hit by a bus, someone else can come in and step in and do that. And then the other piece of it, honestly, is setting good expectations with the client to say, our first swing is not going to be a home run.
Right.
We've been doing this for however long, you've been 8 years, a decade, whatever.
Right.
There's always got to be, for my team especially, that understanding and that layer of, we need your feedback. First draft, where did we hit? Where did we miss? How do we correct? And you need that feedback loop with the client. There's got to be that understanding of, we're not subject matter experts.
Right.
We're going to know enough to be dangerous. and you're going to help us sharpen this to the point that you can be hands off and go, they're nailing it now.
Right. I love it. That's cool. What's the biggest challenge that you folks have when you're working with B2B brands and trying to get these stories out of them?
I think number one, that internal misalignment. And that's something that, you know, when we start, we were productized service. Like, we just create these things. Yeah. Over time, we've had to evolve and iterate to get closer to these internal struggles and be able to have at least an answer or a say or some advice, because most B2B brands struggle because they have no SOP, no process, no internal roles and accountabilities. And so for us, a lot of what stalls out more momentum or kills potentially great opportunities is just a lack of focus and accountability on the client side and a lack of process. And so that's something we try to be very proactive in addressing. I think the other thing that's very easy to control is velocity.
Right.
The faster we can get your feedback on a draft or a cut of video or whatever, the faster we can take it back to the client. B2B moves fast.
Right.
Like, look at the past year, how many people changed jobs, churned out, got reassigned. Like, if you are taking more than, in my view, 3 days, business days to come back with your revisions, you're playing fast and loose because things can change so fast. So velocity is something that can be a big challenge too. So getting people to realize, no, we don't need 9 different stakeholders take on this piece. We need one person with veto power who can move quickly.
Right.
That is something that if you can move fast, you enable so much on the approval side. You make it so much more likely this story ever sees the light of day. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, this is thankfully a gap that we're helpful in filling, but a lack of strategy and clarity on what you want these to do for you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you don't know the types of stories you ought to be telling, if you don't have a sense of where the gaps in your content are, if you don't have clarity on this is who we're trying to reach, or this is the goal of this piece, I think for a lot of teams to this day, they have very shallow targets. It's like a publishing target. We need 5 stories.
Yeah.
The challenge is you need to prove ROI to your leadership. If you want to prove ROI to your leadership, then we want to help you come to a point of knowing where do these fit in your ecosystem. And some of you talk a lot about, where do they fit in your distribution? Like, don't just create that. Don't pay us just to make it and shove it somewhere. Like, how are you going to share this thing? How are you going to publish this thing? So that's somewhere I take inspiration from you and your team, especially, is, you know, like encouraging that conversation.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's such a waste to see organizations produce case studies that nail it in terms of talking about the problem, talking about the solution, and like taking the reader on a journey to really understand, okay, this is the problems that we solve, this is how we do it. And if a client read it, it would increase the likelihood of conversion, but they don't get any amplification. They don't get the spread. There's no paid media to support it. And then they're left wondering, oh, we're creating case studies. Why aren't they working? It's because they didn't do anything with them after they were published. Earlier, you mentioned AI, and I'd be curious to get your sense. Like, what is your take on how AI is going to influence marketers, just like yourselves, when it comes to creating this type of content? Like, is there a world where AI has the ability to take away a lot of our work? Like, what's your perspective on this thing?
I think people are in denial about how much things are going to change. I think there's a lot of fear and a lot of preciousness around only I can do this way. And there's an analogy that I was reminded of this morning. So my next door neighbor, is a widow. She normally has a service come and shovel her driveway and her walk. They haven't been answering calls. So she asked me if I would do it. And she's like, oh, I'll pay you for it. You know, she's like, the service I was paying $150 a month to them, I'm happy to give that to you. And I would have done it for free because, like, I've got to kind of look after this very seriously.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I was like, I couldn't, if I was trying to make money, I couldn't do it for $150 a month. Because the way they do it, they come in with a truck, with a shovel on the bottom, drive up, scrape the whole thing off, get out, do 2 minutes of quick shoveling, and they are done.
Right.
I'm out there with my shovel, all of us doing the whole thing. Now, the parallel to AI is she doesn't care or realize that it's just me out there with a shovel. The end product to her is the same. She does not care about the means.
Right.
And I can't compete with that $150 a month price tag if I'm trying to do this all manually. And I think a lot of people are in denial about the fact that, like, your clients and the world only cares about the end outcome. They do not care how you got there, as long as it's ethical, right? People do care about that. And so I look at AI as a massive accelerant that is only going to get smarter. I don't look at it as an endpoint necessarily in all cases, though in some cases I do, which I'll mention in a second.
Yeah.
But I think marketers are, you know, being very precious about, no, people want my handcrafted artisan end-to-end blog, whatever. Yeah. No, they don't. They want the end product. So for me, I think specific to customer stories, there's things we're already seeing that are exciting, and it's only going to get better. For example, a lot of tools now are integrating what I talked about, that analysis of sales transcripts or call transcripts. They are auto-generating one-pager stories on the back of those transcripts that are very high level, very easy to edit, and for a lot of companies will be enough for a sales call. We are already seeing, you know, for example, for us, we are already testing if we can, I don't want to go from start to finish. We have a hard time trying to go today from a transcript through to a full-fledged, compelling, really interesting, well-told strategic story. That is still a ways off.
Right.
What is more in reach is going from core source material that we've already put that love and care and then repurposing that.
Right.
All the byproducts, social collateral, one sheet, slide decks. Once you've got unique source material, once that is the input, now the output is that much better. So I think on the whole, like, or even to bring it back to one other thing is like, if it can be, if you, something I've been telling people is if you can build an SOP for it, you can build a GPT for it. If there's something, you know, like, let's look at things that are formulaic and repeated, like social imagery, you've got your headshot, your background, your quote. There is a razor thin line separating us from being able to do that on relative autopilot now. That's only going to become, you know, easier to do. So rather than live in fear and be precious about the fact that, oh, my ideas, my approach, my creativity need to encompass the whole thing, I would rather channel AI, bring my best to it, and let it accelerate all the tedium. And I think people pay a lot of lip service to that, but not enough people are playing with it, trying it, and seeing just how far you can go right now, never mind as things, you know, evolve and get more and more dialed in.
I love that. I think there's the preciousness of the work is so real. And you see it every time you log into LinkedIn, someone saying, oh, AI can't do what I can do. In reality, though, it's like with the right prompt, it probably could. You just need to play with it. I want to have some fun on the AI topic. Let's pretend you're no longer a case study buddy. You're working in a B2B company. You're in charge of making 2024 great for this B2B brand, and their entire team is excited about AI. You don't have any pushback. Everyone loves you. What are some things that you would try to do within these organizations using AI to just accelerate their success, help them win, help them grow? Like, what are some things that you would do?
Yeah, so immediately I'm implementing a tool like Gong or something that's capturing sales calls and doing real-time analysis, because coming from the conversion world, one of the big barriers to keeping positioning and messaging current is no one has time to pause and evaluate emerging trends and pull voice of customer. That's the very first thing I'm doing. I'm bringing in the tools and infrastructure to make that happen all the time. The next thing I'm doing is mapping out, you know, very similar to how a lot of content marketing, content strategy happens now, but I'm mapping out the big rocks. Like, what are our big themes? What are our big topics? What are our big pushes? I'm mapping all of those out. And then I'm immediately looking at, okay, once we have this, I just talked about this. Once we have this core source material, how can we use AI to repurpose it and accelerate it as quickly as possible into as many assets as possible so that we can just go test? Beyond that, I think something I'm probably implementing, you know, near term, right away, is bringing in some of these tools on the programmatic ads side of things. I mean, one of the big novelties of AI is it does not get tired. It does not have ego. So you can use it to test ideas, iterations. And if something fails, it doesn't get in a huff, you know, and needs some consoling. It's just, nope, not good, not good. On to the next thing. And so I think especially on the programmatic, like advertising, side of it, the ability to test and gain feedback on a whole lot of iterations, now informed by that ongoing voice of customer that I would put in place, is going to give you the ability to zero in much more quickly on what's actually hitting,
right,
with much less preciousness and ego about it. And then, hey, bring in the creative, bring in the human, bring in the, you know, blow it out, you know, build on that and make it even bigger and more compelling. So I would kind of be looking at that and kind of starting there and focusing in on that side of things. And then, you know, I think the other side of it is I really believe one of the most valuable things any company could be doing is just give people 1 hour a week of playtime. Like the big barrier. And now you mentioned everyone's on board. I love that everyone's on board in this fictional scenario, but everyone on board, I want excited and experimenting. Because the truth is, like, we are so early that new use cases, new opportunities, new ways of combining things are coming out every day. Like, I want someone who's going, hey, we've got this really cool brand iconography. I took that. I used AI to animate it. Here's what it looks like. Let's give this a go. Yeah. Like, I would want to try to use AI to make people like little kids again, just chasing their imaginations all over and seeing, like, you know, what lands for you.
Right. I love it. You've been having fun with the graphic AI. I'd be curious to get a sense of, like, how do you always make them look like you? That's my first question. And then two, what do you think the future is for visual AI? Let's start with the first one. How do you make them always look like you?
Honestly, I have the benefit of being a very generic looking white bald dude with glasses. Like, there really is nothing more to it. People think there's some big secret, and I'm like, no, listen, like, I am bald, I am white, I wear glasses. And, you know, I wore this shirt today on purpose, actually kind of in anticipation of that question. If you want to make something look more like you without doing the whole seed thing, find something consistent, like bring consistent elements back in. Like, I will always be bald, that will always be a thing. Right. But I've chosen to give every avatar of me this red and black plaid shirt. So when people see a pattern, they kind of go, oh, that's Joel. Or I always prompt for square glasses. Same thing. It's just those two consistent elements. I find that people's brains kind of fill in the gap. Yeah. So if it's close enough, like, oh, that's Joel. The other thing is, like, experimenting with styles where photorealistic accuracy isn't necessary. So, like, today I did a post where I made a plushie of myself. Like, it doesn't have a nose. It doesn't need photorealistic features, but you can take those kind of core elements of, like, my visual brand, and that's me, right? So whether it's pixel art, paper craft, some of these different kind of, you know, artistic approaches, playing around with that or clay or whatever, it doesn't have to be as, like, rigorously accurate for people to go, oh, that resembles, that looks like Joel. So yeah, I have the advantage of being, like, a bald white guy with glasses. I think it would be harder if you are more, like, interesting looking human than I am. But still, like, finding those, I think that's kind of key, is finding those consistent elements and, like, prompting them every
time. I gotta bring back the suspenders. I think that's what I'm hearing. I gotta bring them back and just, like, be consistent with it. It's
totally. I literally, like, look to your profile picture as a starting point, or, like, look to, like, if you tend to present in suspenders, or if you've got a streak of pink in your whatever, find a couple identifying characteristics, prompt heavily for those, and then just, it's just literally like, try again. That looks kind of like me, and you're off. Yeah,
that's cool. I like it. All right, future of marketing because of this stuff, like, what do you think is going to happen to designers, photographers, that whole visual world? Like, is this stuff going to shake things up more than it already has? What does the future look like?
Yeah, again, if you can build an SOP for it, you can build a GPT for it. If I apply that same thinking, every well-established brand has a visual style guide, and that is visual inputs that human designers are trained to follow. Those are also things you can train an AI on. So again, I am reticent to say that, okay, well, designers are certainly not going to be redundant. We need their creativity. Like, everything will regress to a mean if we stop having new ideas, if we stop looking for new approaches. So that designer's taste, intellect, approach is still as valuable, in fact, invaluable to push and do something new that isn't in the data set. Yeah. But I do think a lot of things that are, like, cumbersome or time consuming now, certainly, again, get massively accelerated. Like for us, for example, document design, every case study PDF we do for a client has a core set of visual elements that we combine to make it possible. We can bring aspects of that to AI. Every social image we create has aspects that are the same branded elements that we can combine. So I think we're going to start to see, you know, organizations having their own little branded bots who are trained on their visual identity and can generate first wave things that can then be improved on. You're still going to have designers setting the standard, defining the aesthetic, making it better. But I think that's one thing. The other thing that I'm actually like really excited about is I'm a person who like, I've never, you know, I, as a kid, I love to draw, but like, I'm not a visual artist, Like, to be a really good like artist visually, you have to have the power to like deconstruct and then rebuild, to take an image you see in front of you and then you know, deconstruct and rebuild. What's really fun for me now is like, I still wouldn't claim that like, you know, I think the moniker of like AI artist is like tough to swallow because I'm prompting. I'm not like, I haven't really put in the hours to own the artist title, but what's really fun for me is like, that was a barrier previously to having imagery with my posts. To, you know, it's not not every company has the budget or ability or people to pay a designer to do something bespoke every single time. And so what I do think we'll see is just the people are worried about there being a rush of like crappy stuff. I think the better this stuff gets, though, the more rich and exciting content actually gets, because you're enabling people to take it 70-80% of the way. So the other thing I think is really important too is it lowers the bar. We're already seeing this to entry, the barrier to entry for things like video. Now the average person can fire up a tool and get captions on their videos and have some nice looking transitions. And again, it hasn't replaced the need for really good videographers or editors. But the more we can make this stuff easier and more accessible to people, people are worried that it's going to drop the level of quality. I think in a lot of cases, it's going to do the opposite.
Right.
You know, it's going to push us to be better, and it's going to make the minimum standard actually higher, not lower. Because
I think
even less an excuse.
It's so true. It's like when you look at tools like Descript, you look at tools like Canva, like they've all made it easier for anyone who doesn't have Photoshop skills, Adobe skills, like to be able to just like level up and say, all right, here's the bare minimum. If you're going to have talking head videos, they have to at a basic level look like this, because you can do it in Descript. You throw AI in the mix, it's like, all right, now everyone who was mediocre or below mediocre now has no choice but to improve and elevate their game. And now it's like, okay, if I have to level up here, maybe I need to start thinking about more creativity in terms of the content that I'm producing, the stories that I'm telling, and the approach at large. When you think of today's market, let's imagine you're just getting into it. What advice would you give yourself in this day and age to be able to thrive amidst all of this chaos that is happening with AI, with the shifts in the industry? What advice would you give yourself if you're just jumping into the industry and you just graduated from school and you're like, I want to be a writer, I want to get into freelance writing? Like, what advice are you giving yourself?
Yeah, two things. Curiosity over fear, 100%. Like, my first reaction when this all started unfolding, like the minute things really clicked for me, is I logged into ChatGPT, and this was like version 3 or whatever. And I asked it to tell me a story about David Attenborough on acid observing peacocks and like give me a script. And I was astounded. Like it had humor and it was accurate and it nailed the idea. Right. And my first response was, oh, wow. And my second response was, oh, shit. Because But I think curiosity over fear, because there is always going to be opportunities for people who are not afraid. And rather than cower and hold precious and dear the things you've been brought up to know or the ways you've done things before, curiosity will open doors for you. I think the second thing is get your hands dirty. You're not going to learn anything reading people's big X Twitter posts about the prompts you should use. You're not going to learn anything by just watching other people's examples and going, oh, that's really cool. The only way to really see the potential and make yourself useful in this is to immerse yourself in trying it out. And right. It doesn't take much. I've only been doing these AI generated images for 2 months maximum right. on my right. pieces already. People kind of going, oh, you know, this is really cool. How are you doing it?
Right.
There's nothing right. special about me at all. I'm, you know, I'm a pretty basic marketer. So right. I think, you know, like get your hands dirty and try it, because while the 98% are on the sidelines going, what's happening? What's right. going to come next? You yeah. can be in the thick of actually driving it and learning it and embracing it. So carve yeah. out time and get your hands dirty.
All right, let's get tactical for the marketers of the world again. I'm writing a case study. It's brought to life. It's great. How do I use AI to make that case study go further?
I think number one, look at ways of using AI to repurpose. So again, yeah. isolate quotes and translate that's those into social posts, or
right.
take that core piece you've done and use AI to give you an outline or a very rough first draft of a one sheet, or right. you know, to separate that big piece into the structure for a slide deck. Use it to accelerate and open up opportunities for you mm-hmm. to go and repurpose. Don't let it live in a one way, one place, one time. Right. I think ask questions of how might I mean, we talked about jargon and language. Yeah. How might I rephrase this for this audience? How might I change the narrative here? If I was selling into a different audience, one of the big misses on customer stories is we focus out of necessity. We focus on one narrative and then we're done. We're like, right. great, we told that story. When right. really any success story has layers that different people will find compelling. So, you know, look at how maybe AI can help you spot opportunities to make slight adjustments to appeal to a different audience in a different scenario. Right. I think you can use AI even before you get to that case study being created to help inform, you know, what will be created. Like one of my favorite use cases is bouncing my question ideas off of right. ChatGPT. And like, cool. so if I have these goals for the interview, what types of questions could I ask to achieve those goals? Give right. me some questions for each of the goals I've listed. I've used right. that to refine even the interview, right? So
that's cool.
Yeah, there's lots of different applications. I mean, a really practical case study of doing that is we had a live event for someone in a very technical space where okay. we were going to be interviewing technical experts,
right.
30 of them. We That's wanted to have custom interviews for all of them. And oh, by the way, this event is happening in less than 2 months.
That's wild.
The only way, the yeah. only way we got that done was using AI to basically right. feed information about the scenario, give yeah. us a huge list of questions, and then right. chop them down to the ones that we had to have taste and insight.
Yeah.
But because of that, we were able to craft these interviews in a way that captured our clients' goals and captured That's great cool. stories. So those are some of the use cases I see today.
I love that. The idea of leveraging it to help you do things that would have been a gigantic task is fascinating. Because in the future, it's like, all right, we need more people, or we're going to need to spend ridiculous amount of hours and everyone's going to be burnt out. Like it's going to be a drain on everybody's energy, but we're going to get through this thing. AI now gives people a bit of calm in their life and in their work by being able to create thousands of questions that your team can then like filter through and bring this all to life. Do you see AI helping you accelerate like your work? And like, if so, how are you accelerated in terms of AI? Like, are you doing things faster now that you used to take hours to do? You can now do in like 30 minutes and 20 minutes. Like, what are some examples of things that you've seen massive improvements on for yourself?
100%. I mean, when I did our marketing plan for 2023, I, you know, I came with the ideas, I came with the needs, but I used it to help me structure cool. our ICPs, help me cool. lay out our plans, help me prioritize inputs, help me, right. you know, like basically draft section by section. You know, right. one of the coolest things now is I can take my phone, I can speak into it, so I can kind of monologue and right. have that turn into something structured. Because something that, you know, I think really well when I can speak, I can communicate right. an idea by talking through it. Well, yeah. now I can talk to someone who is then going to refine that down. Right. Even more. Another use case for me, we needed to have a policy and approach for gathering G2 reviews. And right. so I put together kind of an initial outline. Then I asked questions like, how can I make this better? What sections might be missing? How can I make this more prescriptive?
Cool.
Okay, help me write those pieces, right? And so I massively accelerated that. Probably my favorite, though, massive savings of time. I was about to go out on pat leave.
Okay.
Baby number three is on the way. Problem is, we're at a stage right now where I was handling all of the inbound calls. We needed to bring in an SDR in like 2 weeks. And I needed to teach that person our CRM, our product, all of that. Well, I used a tool called Scribe. And that basically, process docs that would have taken me hours.
Yeah,
I had an entire library of resources for them to go, here's how you do X, here's how you do Y, here's how you integrate this, here's how you do that, in one day.
Wow.
Everything was pretty much done. Then because we had all this other older documentation on, you know, that marketing plan, whatever, I can now source that and go, okay, I'm trying to teach a new salesperson our value props. I'm trying to help them capture, you know, like, how do we speak about this? Oh, by the way, I've got these transcripts from my own sales calls in Fathom. Put that in, isolate some recurring themes. Now I've got some documentation. So I put together an entire training program and background history on Case Study Buddy for a new SDR in essentially 3 days.
And you're going to have to get tactical on this one. So you've got all these recordings. You've done a bunch of sales calls. They went into Scribe or they went into something else. And then you got Scribe to like, how'd you do all of this?
Let's separate the two of them. So I used Scribe for documentation. So anything where it's like, here is how, like our CRM is closed. Anything where it's like, here's how you do X in close for our specific approach, because we have some automations and things that require like a very methodical approach. Cool. I use Scribe for that. So with Scribe, you literally open up your screen, push record. It's not like Loom. It literally tracks what you're doing on your screen, breaks out. You do the thing. It breaks it all out into steps with screenshots. And after that, you just go in and add context, like do this, do this, do this, do this. So you pop in the context for the screenshots. Yeah. And now you've got this visual step-by-step guide for anything that is like tactical step-by-step. I use that. When it came to, okay, I wanted to be able to give this SDR a background on us, an overlay of kind of the different products we sell and the key selling points for each. I wanted to be able to give them a bit of a competitor analysis. I wanted to be able to give them a bunch of different things. So what I did is, in a lot of cases, we had existing documentation that was good, but not perfect for that use case. Like we had a marketing plan. That marketing plan had some ICPs in it. They were really long. They weren't tailored to like a sales conversation. I took that. And then in ChatGPT, I used the web reader integration. I said, here is this document, isolate this piece, help me turn it into this type of thing for an SDR.
Love it.
Took that, repurposed it. Now I had some accurate documentation that I could give them. I took for our offering, you know, we had existing kind of some notes on, you know, like if you go look at our site, you can see, hey, we have a narrative, we have a snapshot, we have a slide deck.
Yeah.
Fed it that, had it read that page, gave it a little bit more context on each in terms of like production timelines, things like that, put that into a table, copy paste that table. Okay, great. Now we've got, here's an overview. And I just went in and added context. So, you know, I built up this entire library in 3 days based on existing documentation and then monologuing with my phone.
Man, that's gold. That is gold. I know some people though, listening to this, are going to be afraid because there are hundreds, probably thousands of SOP writers who specialize exclusively in writing SOPs who are going to hear this and they're going to be like, uh-oh, what in the world am I going to do? Which to me, I think it is going to be a very difficult time for a lot of writers. And I think it should push you to kind of get into things that might be a little bit more creative, where AI might have a more difficult time replicating the work at large.
I mean, if I'm an SOP writer, again, curiosity over fear, because like, okay, I did that. But what was my special ingredient? Existing documentation. If you're an SOP person, you're doing a bunch of stuff manually. Oh, hell, your job just got easier. Your rate might not change. Like, you can still run those interviews, capture that IP, but you can use Scribe. Right. You can use these tools to distill it down. You can bring that all together. You can bring, I had to figure out the strategy, right? You can package this up, come to people and say, hey, wouldn't it be great to have all of the guidelines for this key area of your business done in a week? I can do that. And so your sales pitch just got even more compelling.
Yeah, I think that's the key piece that a lot of people in the service industry are struggling with. And I want to chat through this because I have the conversation internally, even at Foundation. It's like, folks, AI is not going to replace the strategic thinking that we have. AI is not going to replace our creative thinking, the relationships we have, the partnerships, and our approach to engaging in a community on behalf of a client. None of that stuff can be replaced. What I think is interesting is the idea of like, how do you sell this to clients when they are thinking, oh, time must be reduced, but so why is your price still the same? What I always say is, it's like, we move faster, but the quality is higher. The quality is better than it used to be because we're spending time still doing the work, except we're able to focus on the things that will make it more personalized, more strategic, more high value. How do you view it? Are you trying to, have you folks embraced it from a sense of like accelerating the rate in which you're developing case studies? Or are you viewing it more so as, we're not touching it yet, we just need to create things that are great and let the AI kind of catch up later?
Yeah, I think breaking this apart into how I personally see it and then how we're looking at it, because the tough. Two are different, to be honest. I think on an organizational level, there's still, we need to be careful because we deal with sensitive information. So we need to be really, really confident that nothing we're capturing is like training a model or could be leaked out. We have to establish that comfort in clients. But my perspective on the organizational side of things is like, this is an accelerant. This is something that's going to allow us to produce the same or better level of work in less time. I do think there is going to be some advantage in eventually passing on some of those savings to the client. If I can get done, more in it in a more limited window, then I do feel I can bring the cost down a little bit. I can keep my margins super healthy, but I don't stop there. What can I now do in addition to that to service that client even more? Okay, so my core offer or some of these things got accelerated faster. Great. I bought myself time. Well, what am I going to invest that time in that creates new value, that creates new opportunities, that makes me an even more attractive option for them to work with? Like, I will now turn around and make speed part of my differentiation and then, sell on that and then expand the scope into other new knowledge work types of things that make that speed even more valuable and meaningful to them. So I think, organizationally, like, we are still getting our toes wet. We are still figuring out where and how we apply this and how we do it safely and meaningfully. But for me and my personal, on the personal side of things, like, I want to use this as much as I can for as many things as I can, just to see what happens. It's experimentation, right? It's an opportunity to just like find out and push the limits of what I've known or been comfortable with for so long.
Is there any projects outside of like pure play business marketing, et cetera, that you are intrigued by? Maybe you haven't chased it yet. Maybe you haven't pulled it out yet. Maybe you've got a few prompts that have created some things, but you haven't really talked about it or shared it. Is there any projects you have on the go that you're thinking about or have started to pursue simply because ChatGPT, DALL-E, Midjourney, Runway, all of these tools might allow you to create something that you never thought you could have before?
Yeah.
If you share yours, I'll share mine.
Yeah. Keep a keen eye on developments in music production, because something for me that has been a passion when I was younger and I'm now revisiting when I'm older is writing music. And so, for example, one of the big challenges to creating like orchestral scores and things like that in a DAW is, okay, like, violins are always going to sound a little bit off, or like you can get really great patches and things like that, but it's the nuanced differences in aggregate when you listen to something live that make it sound real.
Right.
I am just salivating for someone to take that concept and say, hey, we're using AI to take this violin input, replicate it 25 times with slight differentiations in each, and now this sounds like a real... So I'm starting to like play around with it for music and see what's coming out there.
Cool.
The other things that really intrigue me are like storytelling and like creating kind of visual worlds. So I have an Instagram that's like very divorced from all my other brands, cause it's really weird. where I just try to make the most deranged, like nothing not safe for work, but the most deranged images I possibly can. Like, I had a post that I put to Reddit where it's like, kiss me under the mistletoe, and it's like a foot rocket.
Yeah.
Like 73 people like upvote. I'm like, that's more traction than I got anywhere.
So it's
like
pretty clever. It is pretty clever.
Yeah, yeah. So playing around with that, you know, I'm enjoying that and creating kind of visual worlds. The other area that I think, you know, I'm really compelled by is the impact that this is going to have on the ability to create video games. When I was younger, I made like a little RPG. I spent a whole summer as a kid, like, you know, it was all built out in RPG Maker. I wrote the music for it. Yeah. I like wrote the story and all the levels and all that stuff. And again, now I just see, like, as a, you know, guy pushing 36 in a couple days, like, I don't have time to sit down and learn all this different stuff.
Right.
So I love that world building aspect. So that to me is like, I guess to bring it to a head, like music and like world building, be that in stories, video games, whatever. What about you?
Same. I'm in this, well, outside of music, I haven't touched music. I'm not going to even go into the music world. I'm not musically inclined enough to even know what half of the things you were saying were about patches and stuff. Like, I'm a musically not, I know I, when I hear something, I can like it, but I'm not good enough to know how to create music. Couldn't start. But I'm geeking out on two key things right now. The video game side, definitely geeking out deeply on that, creating tons of different characters, scenes, etc. Also working in a wide range of different dev tools to see if I can make these things move and interact. That's a side project that I'm going to try to work on. And then on the flip side, I'm a big game guy. So I've also got a board game that I've been itching to make for a very long time. Back in elementary school, I made my first board game, fell in love with that process and that concept. And I've been tinkering for the last year with a handful of those. So who knows? Maybe our games will launch at the same time. Marketers launching games. You can't. Who knows? That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's personally, again, what I'm so excited about to like cap this thought off is like, it opens up creative outlets and pursuits that I had previously been closed off to because now they're accessible to me.
That's it.
That's really cool. And the time savings, again, as like a parent and an older guy, like that to me is like really exciting because it means I can create more and explore more and do more. And like even, one other really quick cipher. So my kid, we play mini sticks in the basement all the time, like hockey. Yeah. There's a bunch of apps that are like scoreboards, but they're all kind of crappy.
Right.
I want to like use AI to help me code like a really badass scoreboard. Like the goal horns from the actual arenas, logos from the teams. And, like, then I want to just like push for a licensing deal with the NHL. Be like, hey, this is a really good way to get kids into hockey. Like every kid kind of plays mini sticks. There's no official NHL app. Like you should have one. And I built it for it. So that's like that's a pipe dream right now, but like, I feel like it would make tens of dollars.
It might make tens, but hey, that's a decent amount. I want to ask a question that I think a lot of Canadians will appreciate. Both of us are Canadians. Some folks have heard your abouts and they've been able to catch on and they've been able to pick up some of the notes and can say, oh yeah, he's on the West Coast. Curious. There's a lot of Canadians in marketing. We probably over-index a little bit. How do you go from a Canadian marketer to working with international brands, US brands? How do you break out of the Canadian market to make that happen?
For me, it was like a natural reflex. My attitude was always like, why limit myself to Canada? Because there are needs everywhere. And I think a couple things have contributed to my ability to do that and would contribute to yours if you're listening. I think number one, go to events in person and meet people there. If you love speaking or think you can speak, pitch events. If you don't love speaking, something I plan to do at every event I go to in the future, plan a dinner, like be the person to like rent the restaurant, put together the guest list, approach people you want to meet and say, I'm putting on this dinner. I'd love for you to be there. I'm getting some really cool people together. Like MozCon's coming up. I'm planning to do this. I want to put that together. Yep. Right. So press the flesh a bit and go meet people in that geographic area so that you can actually come to know that. I think the other thing, though, that's been really key is like niche down, right? Mm-hmm. It's one thing to be the best agency in Calgary.
Right.
It's another to be the best case study company in the world. And that's possible when you solve a universal need in a really focused way and can be known for doing so. Because nobody cares that I'm in Calgary and my partner's in you know, Vancouver area, and that some of our project managers are in Toronto. Nobody has any geographic requirement or limit. They don't care. They want to solve a problem.
Right.
And I think so much of it is just like, go in with the mindset of like, solve a problem that regardless of location, you can be known for solving.
Yeah.
And then leverage the tools you already have available. I mean, LinkedIn is not limited to Canada.
Yeah.
Twitter is not limited to Canada. Instagram, social, like in general, like solve problems in public, the same problem ideally repeatedly, so that you can become known for doing that. And if you've done those things, if you've met real people who can vouch for you and gotten some work behind you, if you have niched down into something that is an acute pain felt all over the place, and if you are solving that acute pain in public over and over and over and over, it is inevitable that people outside of your geographic area are going to come to you wanting to solve that.
I love it. Shameless plug on the MozCon side. Both Joel and I will be speaking 2024. There will be a link to the actual landing page where you can register in the show notes. So sign up. You'll get to hear Joel speak in the flesh. He is one of the best speakers in the game. So I think you'll appreciate that. Or if you can't make the trip, get the live video recordings, all of that good stuff. All right, Joel, I've got two questions. We're going to wrap this with this. Before I became a founder, I wish I would have known that blank, Mad Lib style. What do you wish you would have known before you became a founder?
How important it is to ask for help. I think something that set me back like a lot is in my upbringing. Like, I was a short kid. I always had like a chip on my shoulder. I never wanted to be vulnerable. I think I carried too much of that into my work. You want to look put together. You want to look like you've got the answer. You want to look smart. You want to, you know, play the role of like the person with the answers and all of that. And I think I carried that a little too close to the vest, especially early on, and never wanted to look stupid, never wanted to look vulnerable by asking a question or admitting I didn't know what I was doing. Getting past that has made a really big difference. So I think, I wish I would have known to ask for help and accept help earlier on. And that's a mindset thing that, you know, I had to change.
All right. You're one of the best writers as well. What's the single most important skill to develop to be a great writer?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, at the core of it is empathy. If you can live in the skin of your prospects, if you can feel things the way they feel, see things the way they see them, speak to things the way they speak to them, that will put you advantage. It's not clever wordsmithing. You know, it's yes, research, but research without empathy gets you nowhere. You have to use empathy to dissect and understand and translate that research into something meaningful. So empathy, you know, aside, combined with curiosity, again, just critical traits, but empathy above everything else, I think.
All right. We got to double down on the empathy right before we wrap. How do you build empathy for your audience and ensure that you have that kind of a quality and skill?
Yeah, you have to talk to them. Everyone talks about talking to your customers, but few people actually do it in a meaningful way. And you have to observe. In a time when people look for things that divide or set us apart or put us in this camp or that camp or define us in a particular way, learning to shed parts of that so that you can see the world through someone else. I think that comes through conversation. I think that comes through observation. I think that comes again through cultivating a mindset of curiosity and asking yourself constantly, what if I'm wrong?
Right.
What if that's not true? If you just ask those two questions more often as a writer or as a marketer, you'll get further than, you know, all of the brilliant ideas you can generate in isolation combined.
I love it. Joel, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining and having this conversation. Folks, you need to follow Joel. Joel, tell them where they can find you. I'd love for you to get some followers and some plugs and emails, all that good stuff after this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm most active on LinkedIn. Just look for Joel Klecky. There's only one of us in the world. So I'm active on there. I share quite a bit, and I don't always respond quickly, but I always respond if you send a message. On Twitter or X, I guess it's called now, at Joel Klecky. Yeah. You know, I share some things on there. And then if the case study stuff intrigues you, casestudybite.com, we have a newsletter, we have a huge blog, full of all kinds of practical DIY type stuff. You know, if you're trying to sharpen your skills there, I contribute there. Brilliant members of my team contribute there. Those three places are probably the best places to kind of connect and learn.
Awesome. I like it. Thank you, Joel. Really appreciate it. Thanks for jumping on. And folks, definitely give him a follow and check OK Study Buddy as soon as you can. Thank you.